especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
No, it's a pleasure. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant interviewer, man.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
I really liked your questions.
You're a legend. That's beautiful.
It's best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight, too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Nicole Hayes is an award-winning author, podcaster, and a writing teacher based in Melbourne. Her books include young adult novels A Shadow's Breath, shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award, the 2018 CBCA Notable Book, and longlisted for the Gold Inkey Award. One True Thing, winner of the Children's Peace Literature Award, shortlisted for the 2016 WA Premier's Literary Award and the Yabba and Koala Awards. And The Whole of My World, shortlisted for the Yabba and Koala Awards and longlisted for the Gold Inkey. Catch Nicole on her groundbreaking all-female Australian football podcast, The Outer Sanctum. I'm your host, Danny V.
Welcome, Nicole. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm quite thrilled to be here.
Of course, we're going to talk about your third novel, A Shadow's Breath. But first, something people might not know about you is that you're a fellow podcaster.
I am. My deep, dark secret.
One of the hosts of The Outer Sanctum, an all-female AFL podcast. Tell me about that.
It's this thing that happened kind of over a glass of wine a few years ago with a bunch of friends. Actually, they weren't really friends. We got to know each other through the fact that we all barrack for the same football team. And they had read my book. My first book is based on my life, really, very loosely. But they very quickly identified the football team. And I got to meet them through that. And we just sort of exchanged messages for ages. And then we went out to dinner. And one of us, there's three sisters, one of the sisters, Emma, out of the blue kind of said, we should have these conversations on a podcast. And like a week later, we had microphones in front of us. And 3 years later, we're at the ABC. So it sounds like it happened overnight. It feels like it happened overnight. It also feels like I've been doing it forever.
How crazy is it that these great ideas come when you're just having a glass of wine or something?
The wine was definitely influential in the decision, no question. I've listened to so many of your episodes. It's just such a nice, relaxed conversation. So I can see anyone would be keen to get on board for sure.
Now, this is your third novel. What was the inspiration behind A Shadow's Breath?
Look, all of my stories sort of come to me in bits, but one of the things that had happened in the process of those first two novels is that came out, the both young adult novels, is that I get to meet a lot of young people in my travels and when I go to schools. And I realised that the first two novels, although both main characters had challenges at home, they still were largely safe there.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I met young people, and also I have teenage daughters and some of their friends' experiences, I realised that there's, you know, a whole aspect of that youth today who they're not safe at home. And I really felt like I needed to tell that story, that, you know, it's not all rosy, and that you know, sometimes your parents, the people who are meant to love you the most, are the ones who let you down. And so it's sort of, I knew Tessa was, I always wanted to write a survival story, so I knew that she had a thing that, you know, that had driven her away, and it kind of grew from there. And I can't remember the order of things, but once I got writing about, you know, the landscape and the bush, and it's just such a, you know, I'm a city girl, it's such a dramatic and terrifying space, the Australian bush.
Mm.
So, you know, once I got into that and all the colours and the light, it just was a joy to write. And, you know, it really quickly came to me that why she wouldn't be able to go home. What would be more frightening perhaps than even this dangerous Australian bush in summer?
Yeah, it's funny that you've brought up the Australian setting, because I've noticed in so many Australian novels, particularly young adult, that the setting and the landscapes are so essential to the story, and they're often kind of a character of their own. And the environment in the Now chapters, they were really influencing and driving the characters' actions and decisions.
She's entirely driven by that. It is shaping the story. It represented, you know, in my mind anyway, metaphorically, this kind of trauma that was driving her in the past chapters and what had got her there in the first place. So it was just things kind of were out of her control, and all she could do was respond to it and react to it and then find the strength to actually kind of take control of the narrative herself.
And it's not Australia if there's not a snake slithering around, is there?
I had to have a snake. I mean, seriously, though, what's ironic is I have never actually seen a snake in the Australian bush. And I am married to an American, and their family, whenever I go to visit them, they're always, oh, scary things in America, you know, in Australia, the outback. And I'm like, you know, I live in Melbourne, but anyway, sure. The only time I've ever seen a snake was near their house in New Jersey.
Oh, really?
So that's kind of hilarious, but they needed to be really difficult and also realistic. I mean, you know, it's summer, it's hot, there's a quiet bush. Inevitably, you're going to encounter a snake of some kind.
Absolutely. Maybe the snakes are just really good at hiding in Australia.
They really are, and there's an awful lot of them, so there's that too. Yeah.
Now, going back to talking about the really difficult issues that Tessa faced, I liked how the book didn't shy away from these serious topics such as domestic violence and mental illness and even suicide. You were talking a little bit about it before, but why do you think it's so important for young people to be exposed to these serious issues and continue the conversation with them about these?
Yeah, look, as a writer for young people, I feel a deep responsibility to be really mindful and really careful about the stories I tell in terms of how I tell those stories. I am not afraid of the issues themselves, and I think young people are so much better equipped to deal with them than we give them credit for as a rule. But probably that driving force is what I sort of mentioned a bit earlier, was this: there are people, young people out there whose stories are not being told. And so if I can kind of give them that sense of possibility and hope and they can relate, and that there's sort of life after and hope after, then, you know, I mean, it's a fairly lofty ambition, and for anybody, I don't know, but, you know, I do want to keep trying to do that wherever I can. You know, the idea that young people are not already living with these things is kind of ridiculous, and we know much better than that.
Yeah, and, you know, funnily enough, I was really surprised the most by the fact that domestic violence is so far-reaching, and it impacts others around the person experiencing it more than you would think. And I thought that was really surprising and interesting, because you don't often think of that perspective, do you?
No, and especially in a small town in Carrima, where they live, Tessa's really been taken care of in many ways by her best friend's family, and her best friend's dad, Doug, is the local police officer. And he and his wife, Yuki, have really been the kind of stability and that stabling force that's been missing in her life through most of her teen years. And I wanted that because I think that that's often the case, that there is somebody outside of your immediate family who can really step up, that there are adults out there who see that they can help. And I really loved writing that family. I took enormous pleasure in building that family as carefully as I could. You know, they're not perfect, and her best friend Yuki gets frustrated that it's so hard to be Tessa's friend at points. Mm. But by the same token, she's still ultimately always going to be there for her.
And the mother-daughter relationship between Tessa and Ellen was one of a lot of complexity. How did you develop these characters and their conflict? Because it drives the story.
Yeah, Ellen, Tessa's mum, in my mind, she was always a very good person who just had made some very bad decisions and really was trapped by them, by her own decisions in many ways. So the depression as a consequence of her husband's suicide, the alcohol, they go together so commonly, and once she was, you know, an alcoholic or at least dependent on alcohol, the involvement of her partner for a time, who I never give a name, he's called the arsehole, that becomes an extension of that, a trap. And she's almost punishing herself for not being, you know, the person she wants to be. When she does escape, you know, she's smashed some bridges. She's broken the trust with her daughter. She's not been there in the way that she needs to be. So when we first encounter them, Ellen is very much in apology mode. She is just trying desperately to kind of reconnect with her daughter and to apologize, I guess, for not being there for her. And of course, Tessa doesn't trust that. She can't trust it yet. That's the thing that they have to work on.
And one of the hardest things, I think, for a young person to accept is the realization that your parents are human and they're flawed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And she's deeply flawed, Ellen, for quite some time, I think, or at least when we meet her. But also Tess is very unforgiving. And I believe fair, you know, it makes sense that she would be, but it was also important for me to kind of push that as far as I could go so that there was somewhere for her to go that she had to do a little bit of backtracking too. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that Tessa also is not a perfect character. And so for the two of them, they've just got so much damage and so much work that they have to do together that when those first tenuous steps are made, first by Ellen and then eventually by Tessa to reconnect, it gave it more poignancy, or that was my hope, because it had been so difficult. So even the smallest gestures started to count for so much.
And I like how you said that she didn't forgive easily, because I thought the story was also about forgiveness, you know, forgiving parents for their flaws and mistakes, and also forgiving yourself.
Absolutely. That's probably the driving force. And I didn't know that when I started it, but it really quickly became the thing that the story was focused on, because, you know, I think we forgive other people. Was the idea is we forgive other people, but really it's kind of a gift to yourself to be able to forgive. It's not just about letting them off the hook. It's really about you letting yourself off the hook, but also being able to move on. And I think that's the only way that you can. Sometimes people do terrible things. You can't go backwards. There's only one way forwards. And you have the choice of kind of holding that grudge or holding on to that hurt forever, or trying to let it go by letting them go and forgiving them.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you're often the last to forgive yourself, and it's almost we're very hard on ourselves more than we are other people.
Yeah, and I think young people in particular blame themselves for things that happen when they're young, when it is about their parents. That's a really common thing, because I don't think we think about it as parents enough to talk them through it or to help them through it at the time. And of course, her mum just effectively abandoned her emotionally, psychologically. So when she was, you know, left to her own devices, Tessa inevitably felt the weight of responsibility that, you know, she wasn't the daughter she could have been, or that she couldn't be there for her dad to stop him, or whatever kind of complex arrangement she had, whatever influence she thought she could have had, it just festered because it wasn't tended, it wasn't dealt with in any way.
And throughout the novel, art becomes a motif, doesn't it? How did you feel about art in that it helps us make sense of who we are?
Yeah, I've probably, if I think about all my writing, it's just a thing that I do is to give my main characters an art form. I just, even if they're not very good at it, but it's a way of expressing. I am absolute an evangelist where this is concerned. You know, creative expression is absolutely therapy. There's no doubt. It's my therapy. It's a lot of people's therapy. And I just think if you can find a way to create, you know, to be yourself, to express yourself in a creative space, whatever form that takes, and it could be just storytelling, it could be making podcasts, it could be, you know, making films, or it could be painting, whatever form that takes that gives you some release, I genuinely understand things better after I've written about them. I genuinely feel like I have the potential to move on once I've put it down on paper. And you know, once I discovered that superpower, basically, this ability to kind of, I mean, it's not all, and it's not going to fix everything, but that it's part of that healing process, I really encourage, you know, I think anyone to try it, even if they haven't found what it is. There's something incredible about making something from nothing. It's a really empowering moment.
Absolutely. And I like how you said, even if you're bad at it, you know, or you're not a published author, or you're not, you know, getting thousands and thousands of listens, like, it doesn't matter, because it's about more than that, isn't it? It's about that healing yourself and the process of discovery. And you're right, creating something from nothing is a pretty incredible thing to do.
It really is. It really is. And it's very satisfying if you can just kind of be pleased with the idea of doing that. But I mean, I wrote you know, I've talked about this before. I used to write like really bad poetry as a teenager. That was a thing I did. And I know I'm not the first person to say that, but like, I was never going to get better at that. I'm still really bad at poetry. I used to just like rip off other people's lyrics and turn them around. And, you know, this is all atrocious. And, you know, just really, thank God there was no internet then. That's all I can say. Because I'm sure I would have uploaded it somewhere and I'd be stuck with it for the rest of my dying, you know, my living days. But, you know, I was never going to get better at that. But it, of course, it, you know, I guess language is a big part of that. But they're quite different things. And it's all right to be bad. It's all right to do that because it gave me something really important. And eventually I sort of found my way to what it was I really wanted to do, writing these bigger stories. So, you know, having said that, I played around with painting because I felt like I needed to know how to do that. And yeah, no, it wasn't relaxing for me. It wasn't any kind of therapy. It was just really frustrating and it sucked.
I find it really strange, actually, that society has become so goal-oriented. So it's like you only do something if there's a means to an end. So you only learn if you get a degree and get a job, and you only do this if it leads to something else. And I'm kind of in the space where I'm going, well, why don't you just do it because it's pleasurable or it's fun or you enjoy it? You know, it doesn't always have to have an end to it or a reason.
What is that? I totally agree. I don't understand when that happened. I feel like it's fairly recent. I feel like it wasn't always the way. But I remember hearing an interview with a guy who'd written a book. I think it was like something, one of those slow living. You know, there was that period where everything was being done slowly. That was the new rage, was, you know, slow cooking and slow living and slow eating, all of that. And he, you know, he had sort of this all-encompassing book. I can't remember what it was. And what drove him to it was he was with his, I don't know, 8-year-old son, and his son had just produced this really beautiful drawing, and he'd immediately said to his boy, you know, oh, that's amazing. Would you like to have some lessons? I can get you a tutor. Well, you know, you're really talented. And his son just said to him, can't I just do it for no reason? And it really, yeah, and it really kind of jolted him out of, yeah, of course you can. Yeah. Why am I trying to turn this into a thing?
Yeah.
Just, you know, and I'm sure I'm guilty of it as a parent all of the time. You know, it's this idea that people need to find the thing that they love, but it might take them their whole lifetime. It's just, as long as they're pursuing it, as long as they're trying to explore the world, it you know, it doesn't have to have an outcome.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it just kind of baffles me sometimes where, well, what's the point of learning this or doing this? Well, because it's enjoyable. It doesn't have to, you know, lead to anything particularly. It kind of just enriches you as a person. Like, that's a big deal. That's a pretty big deal.
It's a really big deal, and I think people don't do it enough. But do you never get caught up in it a little bit?
Am
I spending my time properly here?
Oh, definitely, all the time. But it's just a new kind of space where my head's at, where I'm trying to be mindful of it, you know, and I'm trying not to think about doing things because of this, just doing it if you enjoy it. I'm trying, like, it's a new space I'm in. I'm trying it out. But you're right, of course you get caught up in it. I think it's inevitable in our society.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of going through the same thing where I'm trying not to but fall over all the time.
It's like that thing, you know, when you're at a wedding or something and you're doing your small talk, everyone, the first question people ask you is, what do you do? And I read that that's a pretty Australian thing, because in America they say things like, oh, what's your hobby? And I thought, isn't that a far more interesting question than what you do for work?
I did not know there was a difference there. Yeah. That's so interesting.
It's interesting, right? Because it's like, yeah, your job defines you in a way. So I thought that was really interesting. So I try not to ask anymore. I try and go, hey, what's your hobby? People think it's a bit weird, but it's a bit more interesting.
Yeah, you know, I remember I was living in Japan, and one of the things they always ask, you know, the basic lessons are, what is your hobby? And I remember thinking that was odd. Hmm. But that's like it's like the second or third question you learn after, what is your name? And, you know, where are you from? It's, what is your hobby?
Yeah, I like that.
And all my Japanese, when I was teaching English, all my students had lists of hobbies. And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever asked anyone that. But, you know, now you know how to say it in English, so good. Well done.
And I think people might be, well, I dare say I, you know, put words in people's mouths, but people might be more passionate about their hobbies.
You would hope so. I mean, they're doing it for no other reason than enjoyment. So, you know, if you've got a hobby that you don't like, that's, I reckon there's some work you need to do. Try a bit harder.
Quite right. Now, more and more I'm reading positive and authentic representations of characters in same-sex relationships. And I love how literature is normalizing these characters and these relationships. And I particularly like that with Zane. He was a character in your book, and it wasn't a big deal. He just, you know, he is who he is, and that was it. I liked that.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm very aware that I'm running from a really privileged position as a, you know, a white woman growing up in Australia, who, you know, identifies as struct, and so, but my world is not like that. My friends are not like that. Mm-hmm. I'm surrounded, particularly living in Melbourne, perhaps it's more, you know, but certainly I think Australia-wide, people from all shapes and sizes and from all different backgrounds and sexuality and, you know, gender queerness and all those sorts of things. So that is my life. And basically my books are populated by bits of people I know a lot of the time. I mean, not where they're recognisable or they're any one whole thing, but, you know, if I'm not recreating my life, then I at least, or aspects of it, then I don't feel like I'm really being honest about the way things work. So the incidental diversity is a really big part of my storytelling, because my life is surrounded by diversity, and it's not like I went out looking. It's just that's the way things are. And, you know, people are from all different backgrounds, and that's what makes, you know, life fascinating. So I do think we're seeing more and more of that. Probably never going to be quite enough, but or at least not in the short term. But yeah, I actively and carefully make sure that my books look a lot like the people that I'm surrounded by, and the kids my friends hang out. That also represents the sorts of kids who come to my house. My daughter's friends, and you know, the people they play that they play soccer with, and the people in my life. So, yeah, thanks for noticing.
Oh, I think I'm always noticing now. I'm always noticing and really happy when I see diverse characters. I'm like, yeah, like, that's what we need, you know. You don't know who your children are going to grow up to be, and you want them to feel comfortable in the world, and you want them to feel like they belong anywhere, you know. I think it's important for our young people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And my kids are, you know, they're surrounded by people, young people who are genderqueer or LGBTIQ, you know, it's just no big to them.
And kids are like that, aren't they? Kids just love everybody who are nice to them, you know. They don't have any of that prejudice.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I do feel like that's changing, and I do think that young people, especially like the teens, I suppose it's still, you know, hard to tell with much younger children, but they're just so comfortable in that space for the most part. I don't doubt that there are problems still, and you know, all of that sort of conversation we've had around safe schools and people's reactions to it, largely driven by adults, you know, is clear evidence, and the fact that we had to have that ridiculous, you know, vote for marriage equality. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of work to do, but it's certainly better than it has been, and I feel like it's moving fairly quickly compared to how it has in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, bringing up our children in this world now, in the world of change, I think that's a good thing. You know, you might be able to have a huge change in one generation.
Yeah, I think it's already happening. So yeah. Let's fingers crossed.
And one of the lines I loved from the book was, "This is what life was: the good and the bad, the exquisite ache and love and longing." And I thought that was really interesting, because that's what it was. And she kind of accepts that life isn't perfect and life is going to be this way, and she just has to kind of deal with it.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's hard because everything I write is often is me trying to work through my own stuff all the time. But a lot of it from when I was younger, from that age, like I'm absolutely, you know, a 16 year old kid. Sometimes I get a bit older in my heart, but, you know, still grappling with the stuff that didn't make sense to me. And and also surrounded by, you know, I have an 18 year old daughter and a 15 year old daughter, so I'm seeing it play out in their lives as well. And have been for several years, these issues around kind of realizing that things just aren't all perfect. And, you know, as a younger child, you can be protected from it in many ways. But once you're at that coal face in those teen years, it's a lot harder to sort of avoid seeing how things can be pretty messed up sometimes. And there's stuff that's going to happen to you that you're not in control of, that you just have to kind of roll with or respond to in your own way and make sense of. And sometimes the making sense of it is simply accepting that there are going to be bad things, and all I can control sometimes is how I react to it and how I respond to it and whether I let it control me in the way that it can. And you know, sometimes that's just somebody not being very nice to you, and other times it's a potential pathology, you know, that's a realistic thing. And that's where being able to measure when I know how to ask, when I should ask for help and when I can try to work through this on my own. So, you know, Tessa needed help. Tessa needs help and she's getting help, but she wasn't really open to it in the way she needed to be. And it's only sort of as she works through it that she acknowledges, well, there are some things I can't change and some of it is just bad, but also there are these other things that I have that I need to appreciate and kind of allow people to help me in the way that they want to so that I can be a better and stronger person.
And lines like that in books really help build a sense of resilience amongst our young people, which I think is so important these days, or always really.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, resilience. I mean, it's we throw that word around, but gee, it's hard, isn't it, to build resilience. It's not going to happen overnight. And just when we think we're on top of it, another kind of thing confronts us and we realise we're back basket case space all over again.
Yep.
I think it's a work in progress.
all the time,
building that resilience, yeah.
And look, I've noticed a lot of novels lately getting into the structure and the writing process, using the now and the then. I'm always interested in how authors weave these two stories together until they meet up towards the end. What was the process for you in going back and forth between the now and then?
Oh, it was a mess, actually, Dan. I can't even tell you. First I tried to write them in order that they actually appear in the book, and sometimes that worked, and then I would hit a wall because the reality is that the then and now chapters have to speak to each other.
Yeah.
So, but I needed the flow and plot is the thing that I have, and structure is the thing I have to work hardest at. So I have no idea what possessed me to create such a complicated structure. I thought I was challenging myself. Instead, I almost did myself in. I really thought at one point, I am in my head. Yeah, what am I going to do? But I then decided, look, I'm just write them in chronology in when I need to. So when I feel like I've lost control of the flow, I'll just continue those chapters and then I'll find a way to make them work and speak to each other.
Yep.
The challenge always with two narratives like that is making sure they're both compelling.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't feel like you don't want to leave one to move to the other. And I think that's one of the challenges. You know, the now chapters are so much more urgent and immediate. But I had to make sure that there was enough happening in the then chapters to drive, you know, so that you would want to know what had happened to get her there in the first place, or to get her and Nick, you know, why they're in the bush, how they ended up over the cliff, and also that thing that sort of drove that she's afraid to go home, and what it is that drove her away in the first place. So finding that balance is really complicated. So basically, I did it in the order for a while, and then I actually did it just as separate threads, and then mixed them together, making sure that they echoed each other in some way. And so that was a lot of moving around. And I used Scrivener for it, which is the only time I've ever used that program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helps with organisation for sure. But I think I was speaking to Christian White the other day, the author of The Nowhere Child, and he's got a similar structure. And he was saying that it felt like he was writing two different novels at one point, but then you've got to get them to talk to each other. So did you feel like that at some points?
Yeah, look, I didn't ever feel that because Tessa is a thread all the way through. Uh-huh,
yeah.
I guess in terms of structure, it was two separate kind of structures and they both had to kind of align, but also not sort of dominate or not overlap in a way that changed the pace. Mm-hmm. So it was really, when I think about it now, when I read it or read bits from it, it's such a blur, the process of writing it. I really got some denial about the whole thing. But yeah, it was a lot of back and forth and a lot of just trying different things to get it to work. But no, I always, Tess is the thread and her development actually from both narratives is overlapping all the way through. So I didn't feel like they were different books, but I definitely felt I was in a different headspace when I wrote the different time frames.
Yeah, for sure. And so besides the structure, which I just thought was really interesting, because I see it a lot these days, and I thought, I wonder how hard it is to get them to talk to each other and then finally come together in the end. So I'm asking everyone who's doing it to get their different perspectives.
Yeah.
What is your writing process beside that? Do you let the characters drive the story, or do you plot very heavily, or are you somewhere in between?
I'm a pantser with aspirations to be a plotter because it just is so hard to do it that way. But especially as more and more I'm writing stories that are tighter on plot, it's a lot harder to kind of make it up as you go along that way. Having said that, I interviewed Leanne Moriarty a couple of years ago when Truly Madly Guilty came out, yeah. And she's a pantser, a full-on pantser. And given the complexity of her plot and how it's all sort of hinged on one moment and the characters all have to interweave, I was quite kind of encouraged by the fact that she does that. And obviously that means a lot of the work in this setting up the plot and, you know, putting in all the necessary threads and bringing them all together happens in revision. So I thought, look, she seems to be doing all right. Maybe this is my maybe my process isn't so terrible. But I do teach writing a lot. I do it all over, you know, for adults and young people. And the more that I teach it, the sort of more awareness I have that actually there is a bit of a system to it that I'm kind of – I perhaps wasn't so aware of, but I'm more organized than I give myself credit for. And so I just think of those key beats, the key story beats, and I generally know – I know what the problem is. I have a good sense of the character fairly early on, if not right from the beginning. And I know not necessarily what the ending will look like, but I know how it will feel. So, which does sound very vague, but like I know the emotional tone that I'm trying to strike. And that, you know, the theme generally is a thing, or the main dramatic question is the thing driving that. So I know, you know, what level of resolution is involved. I just don't know what it's going to look like until I get there. And I'm actually there with my new novel now, and it's the last few chapters, and I really, really am struggling with it for once. because I feel like I'm second-guessing myself, and I'm not sure that what I wanted to say I still want to say. So, you know, watch this space.
It's interesting you're talking about Leanne Moriarty because you write about her novels. So they, you know, hang off one thread and there's a lot of foreshadowing and all that kind of stuff. And it's a kind of genius to it, isn't it? If it's not plotted really well from the beginning, there's kind of genius to that.
It is, but she says, you know, I do all my work in the revision. Like that's where the time, that's where, so it's there's a lot of going back and fixing things. And she said, and it's really hard and, you know, she doesn't, it's just that that's the only way she can write it. And, you know, I think there is something about being sort of an emotional writer. That's, you know, I'm much more interested in the emotional story and the psychological story than I am the plot. And so it just makes sense that that will move more organically. Like I can't, you can't force an emotion. You can definitely put a plot point in, but how that character is going to react to it, for me anyway, it's such an organic and fluid process that I often don't know what it is, at least in those, you know, in the main, you know, the second act or the main part of the story, I don't know what it is exactly until I get there. And it's just all towards this one kind of ending. Anything can happen really between them because you need the ups and downs, you need the light and dark. So it's very much a process of me letting the character play out once I've got a handle on her.
Now, you've spoken a little bit about your fourth novel, mainly how much pain it's giving you. can you tell us anything about this upcoming novel, or is it top secret?
It's not that it's top secret. It's just that I think it's going to change. So look, it is young adult again. There's a main character. It starts with the death of her best friend. I can tell you that much. And it's really about her trying to uncover the truth of what really happened. Ava's the main character. She finds Leilani on the beach and really, I mean, she's traumatized by the whole thing, but she also just doesn't believe the story. Mm-hmm. And so it's her trying to reconcile the Leilani she knows with this idea that she's being told, you know, this kind of recreation of this character through the eyes of the ex-boyfriend. Just love writing it. But then I got to a point where this ending is kicking my backside for the minute. So I've just got to have a bit. I mean, it's been book week and, you know, book week and Melbourne Writers Festival, and we're about to go into the finals for football. So that's, you know, my life just sort of disappears. So I just want some clear space to just dive back in and really nail this ending. And hopefully it will do what it's meant to do and behave.
Do you find that if you give it a bit of space to breathe, it comes to you?
It definitely does, except that I've given it too much space and now I feel a little lost. So I'm going to have to really reconnect with the story and that will take me – that's basically what it means. I have quite a bad memory. And And, you know, once I'm back in the story, it sort of comes back to me. But because, as I said, this is a lot more sort of plot-driven and there's more sequences that have to really stay in order, it's really hard for me to keep track of all of that. And so to get that emotional story to follow the plot points has been quite the challenge, but also requires me to get really lost in the story again before I can go forward with it.
Yeah, and I think as well, when you're writing, there's so many ideas in your head and only so many of them make the page. And if you give it too much space, you kind of get a bit confused about what you put on the page and what's still in your head. Do you find that?
Oh, absolutely. And also the fact that there are limitless options. Like, yes. I am not an especially decisive person. And so when I get to those points where all the different ways that they can go, that can really just paralyze me. And that's pretty much what's happened with this ending, because I know, like I said, the emotional beat, I know, but there's so many ways that I can show that in this story as it's written. And I am literally like unable to make a decision about it. So I have to get back into it with the aim of just committing to one. I might even, you know, literally pull it out of a hat, like my options, and just force myself to write it, you know, and if it works, it works.
Maybe this novel is your first choose your own adventure novel.
There you go. I could write them all. That's a great idea.
Or you could have a different ending for like the first 1,000 books and a different ending for another 1,000 books. But wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, my God, that is genius. I think you just invented something.
But imagine that. You're talking to a friend about the ending and you're like, that's not how it ended. It's like, yes, it is. You can have these like book club discussions where they ended up in arguments of how it ended.
Oh, my God, you are a genius. That is actually a thing. That should totally be a thing. If it's not, we need to do it.
All right, let's do it.
I love it.
I'm on it. Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for your time. It's been so wonderful chatting to you about podcasting as well as books this time. Usually it's just the books, but I get to talk to a fellow podcaster too. So thank you so much for your time.
It's been lovely. Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.